Galleon. One morning, Randy Waterhouse rises early, takes a long, hot shower, plants himself before the mirror of his Manila hotel suite, and shaves his face bloody. He was thinking of farming this work out to a specialist, the barber in the hotel's lobby. But this is the first time Randy's face will be visible in 10 years, and Randy wants to be the first person to see it. His heart actually thumps, partly out of primal brute fear of the knife, and partly from sheer anticipation. It is like the scene in corny old movies where the bandages are finally taken off of the patient's face and a mirror proffered. The effect is, first of all, intense déjà vu, as if the last 10 years of his life were but a dream, and he now has them to live over again. Then he begins to notice subtle ways in which his face has been changing since it was last exposed to air and light. He is mildly astonished to find that these changes are not entirely bad. Randy has never thought of himself especially good-looking, and has never especially cared, but the blood-spotted visage in the mirror is, arguably, better-looking than the one that faded into the deepening shade of stubble a decade ago. It looks like a grown-up's face. It has been a week since he and Abby laid out the entire plan for the high officials of the PTA, the Post and Telecoms Authority. PTA is a generic term that telecom businessmen slap like a yellow sticky note onto whatever government department handles these matters in whatever country they happen to be visiting this week. In the Philippines, it is actually called something else. Americans brought, or at least accompanied, the Philippines into the 20th century and erected the apparatus of its central government. Intramuros, the dead heart of Manila, is surrounded by a loose ring of giant neoclassical buildings, very much after the fashion of the District of Columbia, housing various parts of that apparatus. The PTA is headquartered in one of those buildings, just south of the Pasig. Randy and Avi get there early because Randy, accustomed to Manila traffic, insists that they budget a full hour to cover the 1 or 2 mile taxi ride from the hotel. But traffic is perversely light, and they end up with a full 20 minutes to kill. They stroll around the side of the building and up onto the green levee. Avi draws a bead on the Epiphyte Corp building, just to reassure himself that their line of sight is clear. Randy is already satisfied of this and just stands there with arms crossed, looking at the river. It is choked, bank to bank, with floating debris. Some plant material, but mostly old mattresses, cushions, pieces of plastic litter, hunks of foam, and, most of all, plastic shopping bags in various bright colors. The river has the consistency of vomit. Avi wrinkles his nose. "What's that?" Randy sniffs the air and smells, among everything else, burnt plastic. He gestures downstream. "Squatter camp on the other side of Fort Santiago," he explains. "They sieve plastic out of the river and burn it for fuel."
"Huh. I was in Mexico a couple of weeks ago," Avi says.
"They have plastic forests there."
"What does that mean?"
"Downwind of the city, the trees sort of comb the plastic shopping bags out of the air. They get totally covered with them. The trees die because light and air can't get through to the leaves. But they remain standing, totally encased in fluttering, ragged plastic, all different colors."
Randy shrugs his blazer off, rolls up his sleeves. Avi does not seem to notice the heat.
"So that's Fort Santiago," Avi says, and starts walking towards it.
"You've heard of it?"
Randy asks, following him and heaving a sigh. The air is so hot that when it comes out of your lungs, it has actually cooled down by several degrees.
"Yes, mentioned in the video," Avi says,
holding up a videotape cassette and wiggling it.
"Oh, yeah."
Soon they are standing before the fort's entrance, which is flanked by carvings of a pair of guards cut into the foamy volcanic tuff, halberd brandishing Spaniards in blousy pants and conquistador helmets. They have been standing here for close to half a millennium, and 100,000 tropical thundershowers have streamed down their bodies and polished them smooth. Avi is working on a much shorter time horizon. He has eyes only for the bullet craters that have disfigured these soldiers far worse than time and water. He puts his hands in them, like Doubting Thomas. Then he steps back and begins to mutter in Hebrew. Two ponytailed German tourists stroll through the gate in rustic sandals.
"We have 5 minutes," Randy says.
"Okay. Let's come back here later."
Charlene wasn't totally wrong. Blood seeps out of tiny, invisible, painless cuts on Randy's face and neck for 10 or 15 minutes after he is shaved. Moments ago, that blood was accelerating through his ventricles, or seeping through the parts of his brain that makes him a conscious entity. Now, the same stuff is exposed to the air. He can reach up and wipe it off. The boundary between Randy and his environment has been annihilated. He gets out a big tube of heavy waterproof sunblock and greases his face, neck, arms, and the small patch of scalp on the top of his head where the hair is getting thin. Then he pulls on khakis, boat shoes, and a loose cotton shirt, and a belt pack containing his GPS receiver and a couple of other essentials, like a wad of toilet paper and a disposable camera. He drops his key off at the front desk, and the employees all do double takes and grin. The bellhops seem particularly delighted by his makeover. Or perhaps it is just that he is wearing leather shoes for once. Topsiders, which he's always thought of as the mark of effete preppies, but which are actually a reasonable thing for him to wear today. Bellhops make ready to haul the front door open, but instead Randy cuts across the lobby towards the back of the hotel, skirts the swimming pool, and walks through a line of palm trees to a stone railing along the top of a seawall. Below him is the hotel's dock, which sticks out into a small cove that opens onto Manila Bay. His ride isn't here yet, so he stands at the railing for a minute. One side of the cove is accessible from Rizal Park. A few gnarly Filipino squatter types are lazing on the benches, staring back at him. Down below the breakwater, a middle-aged man, wearing only boxer shorts, stands in knee-deep water with a pointed stick, staring with feline intensity into the lapping water. A black helicopter makes slow, banking circles against a sugar-white sky. It is a Vietnam vintage Huey, a whoppity-wop kind of chopper that also makes a fierce reptilian hissing noise as it slithers overhead. A boat materializes from the steam rising off the bay, cuts its engines, and coasts into the cove, shoving a bow wave in front of it, like a wrinkle in a heavy rug. A tall, slender woman is poised on the prow like a living figurehead, holding a coil of heavy rope. The big satellite dishes on the roof of the PTA's building are pointed almost straight up, like bird baths, because Manila is so close to the equator. On its stone walls, spackle is coming loose from the bullet and shrapnel craters into which it was troweled after the war. Window air conditioners, centered in the building's Roman arches, drip water onto the limestone balusters below, gradually melting them away. The limestone is blackened with some kind of organic slime and pitted by the root systems of little plants that have taken root in them, probably grown from seeds conveyed in the shit of the birds that congregate there to bathe and drink, the squatters of the aerial realm. In a paneled conference room, a dozen people are waiting, equally divided between table-sitting big wheels and wall-crawling minions. As Randy and Avi enter, a great flurry of handshaking and card-presenting ensues, though most of the introductions zoom through Randy's short-term memory like a supersonic fighter blowing past shoddy third-world air defense systems. He is left only with a stack of business cards. He deals them out on his patch of table like a senescent codger playing Klondike on his meal tray. Avi, of course, knows all of these people already. Seems to be on a first-name basis with most of them. Knows their children's names and ages, their hobbies, their blood types, chronic medical conditions, whose books they are reading, whose parties they have been going to. All of them are evidently delighted by this, and all of them, thank God, completely ignore Randy. Of the half-dozen important people in the room, three are middle-aged Filipino men. One of these is a high-ranking official in the PTA. The second is the president of an upstart telecommunications company called Philatel, which is trying to compete against the traditional monopoly. The third is the vice president of a company called 24 Jam that runs about half of the convenience stores in the Philippines, as well as quite a few in Malaysia. Randy has trouble telling these men apart, but by watching them converse with Avi, and by using inductive logic, he is soon able to match business card with face. The other three are easy.
two Americans and one Nipponese, and one of the Americans is a woman. She is wearing lavender pumps, color-coordinated with a neat little skirt suit and matching nails. She looks as if she might have stepped straight off the set of an infomercial for fake fingernails or home permanents. Her card identifies her as Mary Ann Carson and claims that she is a VP with AVCLA, Asia Venture Capital Los Angeles, which Randy knows dimly as a Los Angeles-based firm that invests in rapidly developing Asian economies. The American man is blonde and has a hard-jawed quasi-military look about him. He seems alert, disciplined, impassive, which Charlene's crowd would interpret as hostility born of repression, born of profound underlying mental disorder. He represents the Subic Bay Free Port. The Nipponese man is the executive vice president of a subsidiary of a ridiculously colossal consumer electronics company. He is about 6 feet tall. He has a small body and a large head shaped like an upside-down Bosque pear, thick hair edged with gray, and wire-rimmed glasses. He smiles frequently and projects the serene confidence of a man who has memorized a 2,000-page encyclopedia of business etiquette. Abby wastes little time in starting the videotape, which, at the moment, represents about 75% of Epiphyte Corp's assets. Abby had it produced by a hot multimedia startup in San Francisco, and the contract to produce it accounted for 100% of the startup's revenue this year. Pies crumble when you slice them too thin, Abby likes to say. It starts with footage, pilfered from a forgotten made-for-TV movie, of a Spanish galleon making headway through heavy seas. Superimposed title, South China Sea, AD 1699. The soundtrack has been beefed up and dolbyized from its original monaural version. It is quite impressive. Half of the investors in AVCLA are into yachting, Abby explained. Cut to a shot, produced by the multimedia company and seamlessly spliced in, of a mangy, exhausted lookout in a crow's nest, peering through a brass spyglass, hollering the Spanish equivalent of, "Land ho!" Cut to the galleon's captain, a rugged, bearded character emerging from his cabin to stare with Keatsian wild surmise at the horizon.
"Corregidor!"
he exclaims. Cut to a stone tower on the crown of a green tropical island, where a lookout is sighting the, digitally inserted, galleon on the horizon. The lookout cups his hands around his mouth and bellows in Spanish,
"It is the galleon! Light the signal fire!"
The family of the guy who runs the PTA is really into local history, Abby said. They run the Museum of the Philippines. With a lusty cheer, Spaniards, actually Mexican-American actors, in conquistador helmets, plunge firebrands into a huge pile of dry wood, which evolves into a screaming pyramid of flame powerful enough to flash roast an ox. Cut to the battlements of Manila's Fort Santiago. Foreground, carved styrofoam. Background, digitally generated landscape. Where another conquistador spies a light flaring up on the horizon.
"Mira, el galeón!"
he cries. Cut to a series of shots of Manila townsfolk rushing to the seawall to adore the signal fire, including an Augustinian monk who clasps his rosary-strewn hands and bursts into clerical Latin on the spot. The family that runs Philatel endowed a chapel at Manila Cathedral, as well as a clean-cut family of Chinese merchants unloading bales of silk from a junk. 24 Jam, the convenience store chain, is run by Chinese mestizos. A voiceover begins, deep and authoritative, English with a Filipino accent. The actor is the brother of the godfather of the grandson of the man who runs the PTA. Subtitles appear on the bottom of the screen in Tagalog. The PTA people have a heavy political commitment to the native language.
In the heyday of the Spanish Empire, the most important event of the year was the arrival of the galleon from Acapulco, laden with silver from the rich mines of America. Silver to buy the silks and spices of Asia. Silver that made the Philippines into the economic fountainhead of Asia. The approach of the galleon was heralded by a beacon of light from the island of Corregidor at the entrance of Manila Bay.
Cut, finally, from the beaming, greed-lit faces of the Manila townsfolk to a 3D graphics rendering of Manila Bay, the Bataan Peninsula, and the small islands off the tip of Bataan, including Corregidor. The point of view swoops and zooms in on Corregidor, where a hokily, badly rendered fire blazes up. A beam of yellow light, like a phaser blast in Star Trek, shoots across the bay. Our point of view follows it. It splashes against the walls of Fort Santiago.
The signal fire was an ancient and simple technology. In the language of modern science, its light was a form of electromagnetic radiation propagating in a straight line across Manila Bay and carrying a single bit of information. But in an age starved for information, that single bit meant everything to the people of Manila.
Cue that funky music. Cut to shots of teeming modern Manila. Shopping malls and luxury hotels in Makati. Electronics factories, school children sitting in front of computer screens. Satellite dishes. Ships unloading at the big free port of Subic Bay. Lots and lots of grinning and thumbs-up gestures.
The Philippines of today is an emerging economic dynamo. As its economy grows, so does its hunger for information. Not single bits, but hundreds of billions of them. But the technology for transmitting that information has not changed as much as you might imagine.
Back to the 3D rendering of Manila Bay. This time, instead of a bonfire on Corregidor, there's a microwave horn up on a tower on the isle's summit, gunning electric blue sine waves at the sprawl of Metro Manila.
Electromagnetic radiation, in this case microwave beams, propagating in straight lines over line-of-sight routes, can transmit vast quantities of information quickly. Modern cryptographic technology makes the signal safe from would-be eavesdroppers.
Cut back to the galleon and lookout footage.
In the old days, Corregidor's position at the entrance of Manila Bay made it a natural lookout, a place where information about approaching ships could be gathered.
Cut to a shot of a barge in a cove somewhere, feeding thick, tarry cable overboard, divers at work with queues of round orange buoys.
Today, Corregidor's geographical situation makes it an ideal place to land deep-sea fiber-optic cables. The information coming down these cables from Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Nippon, and the United States can from there be transmitted directly into the heart of Manila at the speed of light.
More 3D graphics. This time, it's a detailed rendering of the cityscape of Manila.
Randy knows it by heart, because he gathered the data for the damn thing by walking around town with his GPS receiver.
The beam of bits from Corregidor comes straight in off the bay and scores a bullseye on the rooftop antenna of a nondescript four-story office building between Fort Santiago and the Manila Cathedral. It is Epiphyte's building, and the antenna is discreetly labeled with the name and logo of Epiphyte Corp. Other antennas then retransmit information to the PTA building and to other nearby sites, skyscrapers in Makati, government offices in Quezon City, and an Air Force base south of town. Hotel staff throw a carpeted gangway across the gap between seawall and boat. As Randy is walking across it, the woman extends her hand to him. He reaches out to shake it.
"Randy Waterhouse," he says.
She grabs his hand and pulls him on board, not so much greeting him as making sure he doesn't fall overboard.
"Hi, Amy Shafto," she says. "Welcome to Glory."
"Pardon me?"
"Glory. The name of this junk is Glory," she says.
She speaks forthrightly and with great clarity, as though communicating over a noisy two-way radio.
"Actually, it's Glory 4," she continues.
Her accent is largely Midwestern, with a trace of Southern twang and a little bit of Filipino, too. If you saw her on the streets of some Midwestern town, you might not notice the traces of Asian ancestry around her eyes. She has dark brown hair, sun-streaked, just long enough to form a secure ponytail no longer.
"Excuse me a sec," she says, pokes her head into the pilot house and speaks to the pilot in a mixture of Tagalog and English.
The pilot nods, looks around, and begins to manipulate the controls. The hotel staff pull the gangway back.
"Hey,"
Amy says quietly and underhands a pack of Marlboros across the gap to each one of them. They snatch them out of the air, grin, and thank her. Glory 4 begins to back away from the dock. Amy spends the next few minutes walking around the deck, going through some kind of mental checklist. Randy counts four men in addition to Amy and the pilot,
two Caucasians, and two Filipinos. All of them are fiddling around with engines or diving gear in a way Randy recognizes, through many cultural and technological barriers, as debugging. Amy walks past Randy a couple of times, but avoids looking him in the eye. She's not a shy person. Her body language is eloquent enough. I am aware that men are in the habit of looking at whatever women happen to be nearby in the hopes of deriving enjoyment from their physical beauty, their hair, makeup, fragrance, and clothing. I will ignore this, politely and patiently, until you get over it. Amy is a long-limbed girl in paint-stained jeans, a sleeveless t-shirt, and high-tech sandals, and she lopes easily around the boat. Finally, she approaches him, meeting his eyes for just a second, and then glancing away as if bored.
"Thanks for giving me the ride," Randy says.
"It's nothing," she says.
"I feel embarrassed that I didn't tip the guys at the dock. Can I reimburse you?"
"You can reimburse me with information," she says without hesitation. Amy reaches up with one hand to rub the back of her neck. Her elbow pokes up in the air. He notices about a month's growth of hair in her armpit, then glimpses the corner of a tattoo poking out from under her shirt.
"You're in the information business, right?"
She watches his face, hoping that he'll take the cue and laugh, or at least grin. But he's too preoccupied to catch it. She glances away, now with a knowing, sardonic look on her face. "You don't understand me, Randy, which is absolutely typical, and I'm fine with that." She reminds Randy of level-headed blue-collar lesbians he has known, drywall-hanging urban dykes with cats and cross-country ski racks. She takes him into an air-conditioned cabin with a lot of windows and a coffee maker. It has fake wood veneer paneling like a suburban basement, and framed exhibits on the walls, official documents like licenses and registrations, and enlarged black-and-white photographs of people and boats. It smells like coffee, soap, and oil. There is a boombox held down with bungee cords and a shoebox with a couple of dozen CDs in it, mostly albums by American woman singer-songwriters of the offbeat, misunderstood, highly intelligent but intensely emotional school, getting rich selling music to consumers who understand what it's like not to be understood. An evident paradox, but nothing out of the ordinary. Being out of America has just made this kind of thing more obvious to Randy. Amy pours two mugs of coffee and sets them down on the cabin's bolted-down table, then fishes in the tight pockets of her jeans, pulls out a waterproof nylon wallet, extracts two business cards, and shoots them across the table, one after the other, to Randy. She seems to enjoy doing this. A small, private smile comes onto her lips and then vanishes the moment Randy sees it. The cards bear the logo of Semper Marine Services and the name America Shafto.
"Your name's America?" Randy asks.
Amy looks out the window, bored, afraid he's going to make a big deal out of it.
"Yeah,"
she says.
"Where'd you grow up?"
She seems to be fascinated by the view out the window, big cargo ships strewn around Manila Bay as far as the eye can see, ships hailing from Athens, Shanghai, Vladivostok, Cape Town, Monrovia. Randy infers that looking at big rusty boats is more interesting than talking to Randy.
"So, would you mind telling me what's going on?"
she asks. She turns to face him, lifts the mug to her lips, and finally looks him straight in the eye. Randy's a little nonplussed. The question is basically impertinent coming from America Shafto. Her company, Semper Marine Services, is a contractor at the very lowest level of Abbey's virtual corporation, only one of a dozen boats and divers outfits that they could have hired. So this is a bit like being interrogated by one's janitor or taxi driver. But she's smart and unusual, and precisely because of all her efforts not to be, she's cute. As an interesting female and a fellow American, she is pulling rank, demanding to be accorded a higher status. Randy tries to be careful.
"Is there something bothering you?"
he asks. She looks away. She's afraid she's given him the wrong impression.
"Not in particular," she says. "I'm just nosy. I like to hear stories. Divers always sit around and tell each other stories."
Randy sips his coffee. America continues.
In this business, you never know where your next job is going to come from. Some people have really weird reasons for wanting to get stuff done underwater, which I like to hear. She concludes, "It's fun," which is clearly all the motivation she needs. Randy views all of the above as a fairly professional bullshitting job. He decides to give Amy press release material only. All the Filipinos are in Manila. That's where the information needs to go. It is somewhat awkward getting information to Manila because it has mountains in back of it and Manila Bay in front. The bay is a nightmare place to run some marine cables. She's nodding. Of course, she would know this already. Randy hits the fast forward. Corregidor's a pretty good place. From Corregidor, you can shoot a line-of-sight microwave transmission across the bay to downtown Manila. So you're extending the North Luzon coastal festoon from Subic Bay down to Corregidor? She says.
Two things about what you just said, Randy says, and pauses for a moment to get the answer queued up in his output buffer. One, you have to be careful about your pronouns. What do you mean when you say you? I work for Epiphyte Corporation, which is designed from the ground up to work, not on its own, but as an element in a virtual corporation, kind of like,
I know what an Epiphyte is, she says. What's two?
Okay, good, Randy says.
A little off balance.
Two is that the extension of the North Luzon festoon is just the first of what we hope will be several link-ups. We want to lay a lot of cable eventually into Corregidor.
Some kind of machinery behind Amy's eyes begins to hum. The message is clear enough. There will be work aplenty for Semper Marine if they handle this first job well.
In this case, the entity that's doing the work is a joint venture, including us, Philatel, 24 Jam, and a big Nipponese electronics company, among others.
What does 24 Jam have to do with it? They're convenience stores.
Well, they're the retail outlet, the distribution system for Epiphyte's product.
And that is?
Pinoygrams.
Randy manages to suppress the urge to tell her that the name is trademarked.
Pinoygrams? Well, here's how it works. You are an overseas contract worker. Before you leave home for Saudi or Singapore or Seattle or wherever, you buy or rent a little gizmo from us. It's about the size of a paperback book and encases a thimble-sized video camera, a tiny screen, and a lot of memory chips. The components come from all over the place. They are shipped to the free port at Subic and assembled in a Nipponese plant there. So they cost next to nothing. Anyway, you take this gizmo overseas with you. Whenever you feel like communicating with the folks at home, you turn it on, aim the camera at yourself, and record a little video greeting card. It all goes onto the memory chips. It's highly compressed. Then you plug the gizmo into a phone line and let it work its magic.
What's the magic? It sends the video down the phone line?
Right.
Haven't people been messing around with video phones for a long time?
Well, the difference here is our software. We don't try to send the video in real time. That's too expensive. We store the data at central servers, then take advantage of lulls when traffic is low through the undersea's cables, and shoot the data down those cables when time can be had cheap. Eventually, the data winds up at Epiphyte's facility in Entremoros. From there, we can use wireless technology to send the data to 24 Jam stores all over Metro Manila. The store just needs a little pie plate dish on the roof and a decoder and a regular VCR down behind the counter. The Pinoygram is recorded on a regular videotape. Then when Mom comes in to buy eggs or Dad comes in to buy cigarettes, the storekeeper says, "Hey, you got a Pinoygram today," and hands them the videotape. They can take it home and get the latest news from their child overseas. When they're done, they bring the videotape back to 24 Jam for reuse. About halfway through this, Amy understands the basic concept, looks out the window again, and begins trying to work a fragment of breakfast out of her teeth with the tip of her tongue. She does it with her mouth tastefully closed, but it seems to occupy her thoughts more than the explanation of Pinoygrams. Randy is gripped by a crazy, unaccountable desire not to bore Amy. It's not that he is getting a crush on her, because he puts the odds at 50-50 that she's a lesbian, and he knows better. She is so frank, so guileless, that he feels he could confide anything in her, as an equal. This is why he hates business. He wants to tell everyone everything. He wants to make friends with people.
So, let me guess, she says. You are the guy doing the software.
Yeah, he admits, a little defensive.
But the software is the only interesting part of this whole project. All the rest is making license plates. That wakes her up a little.
Making license plates?
It's an expression that my business partner and I use, Randy says. With any job, there's some creative work that needs to be done, new technology to be developed or whatever. Everything else, 99% of it, is making deals, raising capital, going to meetings, marketing and sales. We call that stuff making license plates. She nods, looking out the window. Randy is on the verge of telling her that Pinoygrams are nothing more than a way to create cash flow, so that they can move on to part two of the business plan. He is sure that this would elevate his stature beyond that of dull software boy. But Amy puffs sharply across the top of her coffee like blowing out a candle and says, "Okay, thanks. I guess that was worth the 3 packs of cigarettes."